The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. You can pay over 100 different bills free at the post office. Unpost. Do more.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, we have been joined in studio by two other gentlemen, Roddy Flynn, DCU School of Communications, and Rowan Mahanan, TEDx Dublin organiser and consultant. And this we're now hitting the 30th, which actually really took me by surprise, anniversary of TED. And those who are interested in TED are very, very interested. And those, there are some people listening thinking, what in the name of God is she talking about? So could I ask you, if you would, Roddy, to explain what TED is?
Yeah, well, it stands for Technology, Entertainment and Design. And I suppose it's been around, as you say, since 1984. It was set up by an architect and a designer, I guess, called Richard Wurman, now run by a guy called Chris Anderson. And it's I guess it's a reflection of what began to happen to technology in the 1980s and which has continued then, the convergence of different technologies, bringing fields that were previously considered very separate, like entertainment, like science, and all the areas of science, so neuroscience and biology, et cetera, bringing them all into one kind of area. And I guess they're short talks. I think the rule is they can only be 18 minutes long.
Yep.
And they're little sort of provocations. They're brief introductions into kind of new ideas, usually on the kind of on the cutting edge of science, and suggestions about basically where that science might be going. And the very best ones are absolutely, absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, there are some of them that are terrific. But I was reading an article this morning about people saying it was entitled "We Need to Talk About TED," that it has nearly become, what do they call it, infotainment, as opposed to substantial, and that the style sort of has overcome. Quoting one particular person who was an astrophysicist who was doing something and had explained it in very simple, accessible terms and was told, no, put it in, your own personal experience make it more accessible. So the actual science went down the priority list and the entertainment went up. But you don't agree?
I understand and I absolutely sympathise, because we have this problem constantly. I work with all of the speakers who come through for TED Dublin, which is a big event now. It's an annual event. There's 2,200 people in the Bordgash Theatre. And therefore, you have almost no experts in your field. Whatever your field might happen to be, there are going to be very few, if any, experts in the room. So what you need to do is make it accessible to those non-experts. Mm. This isn't an academic conference. You're not looking to present peer-reviewed material in a way that withstands the kind of scrutiny that Professor Robertson has to deal with all the time when he's at his conferences. On the other hand, yes, I nod my head, because you can take it too far. It can get schmaltzy. It can get too oversimplified and too soundbitey. And I hate when that happens. And it does happen. It inevitably happens. One of the key rules, for example, of TED, which is a not-for-profit organization, it's nobody makes any money out of it. One of the key rules is you're not allowed to sell from the stage. And I think that's why an awful lot of people love TED. There's no ads. There's a sponsorship slidey thing at the beginning of the video, if your talk gets videoed, but that's it. There's no ads, there's no interruption, there's no commercialization of anything on the website or at the conferences, and therefore you're also not supposed to stand up there and do your usual shtick and talk about what it is, the book that you've just written or the service or idea or product that you just had. And I think this is why so many people have gravitated toward it, because most conferences devolve into selling from the stage, and we've managed to try and hold that back. Sometimes it slips in.
Okay, let us go. And we've a couple of clips. I think people will find the range of this very interesting. Now, the first clip, Ken Robinson, creativity expert. Sir Ken Robinson challenging the way we're educating our children.
I have an interest in education. Actually, what I find is everybody has an interest in education. Don't you? I find this very interesting. If you're at a dinner party and you say you work in education, actually, you're not often at dinner parties, frankly. if you work in education. You're not asked, you know, and and you're never asked back, curiously. That's a thing that strikes me. But if you are, and you say to somebody, they say, what do you do? And you say, you work in education, you can see the blood run from their face. They think, oh, my God, you know, why me? It's my one night out all week. But if you ask people about their education, they pin you to the wall. Because it's one of those things that goes deep with people. Am I right? Like religion and money and other things. So I have a big interest in education, and I think we all do. We have a huge vested interest in it, partly because it's education that's meant to take us into this future that we can't grasp. If you think of it, children starting school this year will be retiring in 2065. Nobody has a clue, despite all the expertise that's been on parade for the past 4 days, what the world will look like in 5 years' time. And yet we're meant to be educating them for it. So the unpredictability, I think, is extraordinary. And the third part of this is that we've all agreed, nonetheless, on the really extraordinary capacities that children have, their capacities for innovation. And my contention is all kids have tremendous talents, and we squander them pretty ruthlessly. So I want to talk about education, and I want to talk about creativity. My contention is that creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status. Thank you. That was it, by the way. Thank you very much. So, 15 minutes left. Well, I was born. No, the.
Actually, that's a really interesting illustration actually, of the earlier point about where these texts or where they lie. Are they entertaining?
Yeah.
Are they educational? I mean, just looking at that's about 2 minutes long, and maybe a minute of that is him having fun. Basically, he's not really telling us anything. And there are absolutely there are ones that only do that, and you come away with it thinking, well, I haven't really got anything that I can go away with.
Well, you know the funny thing about that one. That has been voted number one favourite.
Oh, by a mile.
Yeah. It's the most listened to.
But it's was one of the first released as well, which it has the advantage there.
Wonderful timing. I mean, he could go on the stage. The timing of those little funny lines.
And it gets only better.
Yeah.
It gets only better. His talk is brilliant.
But the point is that is in support of a really interesting idea. Now, whether one agrees with that notion about creativity being as important as literacy.
What was the overall duration of that one?
Talk.
Yeah.
About 17, 18 minutes.
Yeah, they're all around the 18 mark. And we, by the way, we'll put the whole lot of them up on our website in full. I mean, we're going to go through clips now to get a sense of what it does, but that will be available for people.
I'm looking at the list here, but that's certainly one not to be missed. It's a stunning.
Right. Funnily enough, the next one I rather really liked, it was somebody sent it to me in a context of, you know, other nationalities and other areas of poverty, and it's the education researcher Sugata Maitra.
Oh, yes.
He helped me design the School in the Cloud, a learning lab in India where children can explore and learn from each other using resources and mentoring from the cloud.
I used to teach people how to write computer programs in New Delhi 14 years ago, and right next to where I used to work there was a slum. And I used to think, how on earth are those kids ever going to learn to write computer programs? Or should they not? At the same time, we also had lots of parents, rich people, who had computers, and who used to tell me, you know, my son, I think he's gifted because, you know, he does wonderful things with computers. And my daughter, oh, surely she's, you know, extra intelligent and so on. So I suddenly figured that how come all the rich people are having these extraordinary gifted children? What did the poor do wrong? I made a hole in the boundary wall of the slum next to my office and stuck a computer inside it just to see what would happen if I gave a computer to children who never would have one, didn't know any English, didn't know what the internet was. The children came running in, it was 3 feet off the ground, and they said, what is this? And I said, yeah, it's, you know, I don't know. So they said, why have you put it there? I said, just like that. And they said, can we touch it? I said, if you wish to. And I went away. About 8 hours later, we found them browsing and teaching each other how to browse. So I said, but that's impossible. They don't know anything. My colleague said, no, it's a simple solution. One of your students must have been passing by, showed them how to use the mouse. So I said, yeah, that's possible. So I repeated the experiment. I went 300 miles out of Delhi into a really remote village where the chances of a passing software development engineer was very little. I repeated the experiment there. There was no place to stay, so I stuck my computer in, I went away, came back after a couple of months, found kids playing games on it. When they saw me, they said, we want a faster processor and a better mouse. So I said, how on earth do you know all this? And they said something very interesting to me. In an irritated voice, they said, you've given us a machine that works only in English, so we had to teach ourselves English in order to use it. That's the first time as a teacher that I heard the word teach ourselves said so casually.
And it goes on, and they taught themselves other things as well, including there was one group of educated people who had very accented English, and if they wanted to get on in their chosen sphere, they had to have better English. But it became voice activated, and it wouldn't activate unless you used the correct pronunciation.
Ah, stunning. Stunning.
I was a teacher in Fiji many years ago, and this very well-behaved class of young Indian children, and I taught them maths. And after a month, I said, well, I better give them a test. So I gave them a test, and they were all very bright. They all got zero. I thought, my goodness, I can't teach. Then I realised I'd been speaking in a broad Glasgow accent. They had sat for a month and not understood a single word that I had said. So I could have done with that device.
Okay, special cleaning, you might say, but, you know, just listening to the first clip, I mean, it does seem to me children are tremendously creative, and he's absolutely right that we won't know the future. But at the risk of getting into deep water, literacy is the operating system. You teach children how to use words clearly, use them correctly, what they're for. And then it doesn't matter how the world has turned out. They can build on that. But do it the other way around and make them creative, like the kids, you know, having to learn English and all the rest. Make them creative without them having that fundamental grasp of communication from the human brain. And we've had 40 years in schools, particularly in the UK, of going down that road. And I think all the evidence is that it's been a disaster, but you cannot get it out of the academic world.
But to be fair,
that creativity comes first.
He's not suggesting that.
It's a key point in this question, because the world is changing so fast and nobody knows what it's like. You know, the education system can only give you the building blocks. Being creative with today's machines, as you say, 5 years' time, because of a waste of time, you know.
But I think that illustrates the whole tension with the TED thing for myself as an academic. Like, I'm a sociologist, and it's a good way of putting out new sociological ideas, and people in social sciences use TED a lot. And it's a kind of a double-edged sword, because on one level there's always a fear, particularly with sociologists like myself who work a lot in the public sphere, and you're trying to put a new idea out there, and there's always a concern that, you know, the kind of record shop issue, you know, I mean, that if you write a book about something and you do a TED, that maybe people won't down the line go and look and read the book and talk about the more complex, you know,
Carl Sagan
foundation. Exactly.
Yes.
Sorry, you wanted to come in?
Well, no, it's just because I used TED in the context of this thing called Moodle. It's a virtual learning environment. So I'd put up the clips for students. But I do have to kind of stress the point that, look, this is the beginning of the map. This is not the world that you're looking at. So this is merely a starting point. And I'd be terrified if anybody said, that's enough. Just listen to those 18 minutes.
Like a taster.
Yeah, it is just that. Like,
the strap line for the whole TED movement, as it were, is ideas worth sharing, which I think is a stunning, elegant little concept. And I think far too many people expect it to be more than that. All it does is get a conversation going.
Well, I concede that. Anyway,
we had the 5 year old during the week who was spending €150 a month buying games online, right? And, you know, the fact is, like, he was 5 years of age. He was doing all this himself. His parents didn't know. Very creative. You know, he can make work on the machines.
There's the making of the presentation there.
Let me go to another one now, which is Sean Acor, is it?
Acor.
Acor. Okay, tell me about it.
Sean is he's a social psychologist, and he is looking at what makes us happy in our working lives in particular. And obviously that is the thing that that most people in the developed world spend most of their waking hours doing, is working. So he gives a very interesting lead in.
But if I'm interested in potential, if I'm interested in your potential or for happiness or productivity or energy or creativity, what we're doing is we're creating the cult of the average with science. If I ask a question like, how fast can a child learn how to read in a classroom? Scientists change the answer to, how fast does the average child learn how to read in that classroom? And then we tailor the class right towards the average. Now, if you fall below the average on this curve, then psychologists get thrilled, because that means you're either depressed or you have a disorder, or hopefully both. We're hoping for both, because our business model is, if you come into a therapy session with one problem, we want to make sure you leave knowing you have 10. So you'll keep coming back over and over again. We'll go back into your childhood if necessary, but eventually what we want to do is to make you normal again. But normal is merely average. And what I posit, and what positive psychology posits, is that if we study what is merely average, we will remain merely average. Then instead of deleting those positive outliers, what I intentionally do is come into a population like this one and says, why? Why is it that some of you are so high above the curve in terms of your intellectual ability, athletic ability, musical ability, creativity, energy levels, your resiliency in the face of challenge, your sense of humor? Whatever it is, instead of deleting you, what I want to do is study you. Because maybe we can glean information, not just how to move people up to the average, but how we can move the entire average up at our companies and schools worldwide. The reason this graph is important to me is when I turn on the news, it seems like the majority of the information is not positive. In fact, it's negative. Most of it's about murder, corruption, diseases, natural disasters, and very quickly, my brain starts to think that's the accurate ratio of negative to positive in the world. What that's doing is creating something called the medical school syndrome, which, if you know people who have been to medical school during the first year of medical training, as you read through a list of all the symptoms and diseases that could happen, suddenly you realize you have all of them.
And
his brother-in-law rang him shortly after that talk to tell him he had leprosy.
Just before we talk anymore, I want to go to one other one. This is Schwartz Paradox. Do you know which one this
is? Yeah, this is fantastic. Barry Schwartz is a psychologist, although when you listen to this, he could be an economist or he could be a politician, because he uses language from both discourses. But he's basically discussing is whether choice is a good thing. Interesting question.
Let's have a listen.
So, in other aspects of life that are much more significant than buying things, the same explosion of choice is true. Healthcare. It is no longer the case in the United States that you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you what to do. Instead, you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you, well, we could do A or we could do B. A has these benefits and these risks. B has these benefits and these risks. What do you want to do? And you say, Doc, what should I do? And the doc says, A has these benefits and risks, and B has these benefits and risks. What do you want to do? And you say, if you were me, doc, what would you do? And the doc says, but I'm not you. And the result is, we call it patient autonomy, which makes it sound like a good thing, but what it really is a shifting of the burden and the responsibility for decision-making from somebody who knows something, namely the doctor, to somebody who knows nothing and is almost certainly sick and thus not in the best shape to be making decisions, namely the patient.
And presumably with an eye on the insurance policy.
You'd be very lucky to get a choice of only two.
just try making a decision on which phone carrier you're going to go with and which plan you're going to go with. It is utterly bewildering.
Try health insurance.
It's health insurance.
Health insurance even worse. College courses. My teenage daughter is starting to think about subject choices for leaving certificates.
But with college in mind, doesn't this go back to the
bewildering?
Doesn't this go back to the information technology? When I was a young reporter in the days of paper, right here in RTE, we'd have got about 10 foreign business stories on the wire each afternoon, right? Now, on your computer screen, there's 500 every day. And so how are we supposed to cope with this?
Choice is very time-consuming.
Choice is all over the place. Yeah.
I saw a wonderful quote from somebody in Wired magazine in the UK, and he said, trying to find a little bit of information on the internet is like trying to take a sip of water from an open fire hydrant.
But I think what's really interesting about this piece is that it does talk about the tyranny of choice. And he ultimately comes up with a very political point, which is that actually maybe choice is not such a good idea.
If you take small children, if you say, which would you rather do, which will you have, or sweets or whatever, and they never make a decision. Whereas if you say, that's the best one.
Well, you can do that, Mary, when they say they want a bar of chocolate and you can say, well, you can have an apple or an orange.
That's very true.
I'll ask the psychologist in the room, at what stage developmentally can kids make the difference between two, is it 15 months, 18 months, when you offer them two things and they can hold two in their head and make a decision on that basis?
I wish I could answer that, Rowan, off the top. I'd have to go and look up.
I
have to Google
it's
that.
It's somewhere before the terrible twos. I noticed the terrible twos happen just after you start giving them choices. I wonder, is that why?
Okay, listen, we're going to have to leave it there, and you can get them at web. When is the next one in Dublin?
We're looking at September. We're waiting for a date from the theatre as to you know, between War Horse and various other shows that are out there. We're in downtime in the theatre, and we're absolutely so excited for some of the speakers we've got already in
that's
line
great.
For this year.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you to all our guests and contributors this morning. That's all we've time for. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Anne Farrell, research Richie Byrne, broadcasting coordinator Jarlath Hallin, Sheila Neveal on sound. Back with you next Saturday and Sunday, 11 to 1. Hope you can join us then. Until then, a very good day to you.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. Sterling and dollars are commission free at selected post offices. Unpost. Do more.